Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin. Before we dive into our show today, a few housekeeping notes. First, I'd like to mention that we will have a special treat next week on the show. For the past 2.5 years, you have heard me interview over 135 guests on a wide variety of topics. You may not have known, though, that in addition to providing this free service to the general public, that I am a scholar in my own right. And next week, the tables will be turned. I am inviting a guest host onto the show to interview me and put my scholarship under the microscope. We'll be talking about my recent book, The Political Origins of Religious Liberty, so please join us for that discussion. Second, I would like once again to thank the good folks at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion for sponsoring this show. Part of their mission is not only to produce great research around the topic of faith and spirituality, but also to disseminate that work to as broad of an audience as possible. We at Research on Religion are part of that goal and are grateful for ISR support. Please drop by their website, www.baylorisr.org, and say hello. We'll post that link up on our website as well. They have lots of great research reports and other goodies that are free to the public, so if you are an educator, a student, or just somebody who is curious, stop by and give them a holler. Finally, I'd like to remind our listeners that we are on Facebook, and we would be delighted if you could join us there by liking our fan page. Each week, I offer up a couple postings about what topics will be coming up in the future and a few additional tidbits related to the show. We will provide the link to our fan page on our regular website, so stop by and like us. Okay, on with the regular show. It's New Year's Eve on 2012, and looking back at the calendar, I just remembered that this is the 50th anniversary of the beginning of the Second Vatican Council. Given that we have mentioned that momentous event several times on this podcast, it would be remiss of me to not have some discussion about what went on in the Vatican for 3 years between 1962 and 1965. Fortunately, with 1 day left on the calendar year, I'm not too late in celebrating the opening of Vatican Council II, or at least its 50th anniversary. To discuss the reasons for and the impact of the Second Vatican Council, who better to talk with than my favorite Catholic historian, James Felak? You've heard James on this program twice before discussing Pope John Paul II and Pope Pius XII, two of my favorite episodes because Professor Felak is not only knowledgeable on the topic of the popes, but he provides a passionate presentation as well. Just as a reminder for folks who didn't catch those earlier shows, Dr. Felak is a professor of history at the University of Washington and author of After Hitler, Before Stalin, Catholics, Communists, and Democrats in Slovakia, 1945 to 1948. And he's still working on the history of the 20th century popes, which should be out soon. James, welcome back to Research on Religion.
Glad to be here.
How's that book on the popes coming along?
Well, actually, it's a book specifically on John Paul II. And it'll be on his 8 visits to Poland, the first 3 to communist Poland and the last 5 to Poland as it transitions into a Western democracy. So that's coming along. I'm hoping to go to Poland in the spring for some research.
Very cool. Well, we're going to look forward to that. So, yeah, it's not the 20th century, just the Pope John Paul II. So I get that right.
And I did a lecture series on the popes of the 20th century.
That's where I always get confused because that was a great lecture series here at the University of Washington. But when that book comes out, we'll get you back on the show again. But we are here to talk about 50-year anniversaries, because 50-year anniversaries are a big deal. And I know this because my wife and I just celebrated our 20th wedding anniversary.
Congratulations.
And, yeah, thank you very much. And that was a big deal. And so I figured a 50-year anniversary, well, that's 2.5 times bigger. However, and this is somewhat curious, I haven't seen anybody making a big deal about this in the media or anywhere. Maybe it's because I don't run in Catholic circles, so I don't hear about this very much. But I think I do have my ear to the ground on all things religious, and it it just doesn't seem to have been popping up anywhere. And this morning I went and looked at the Vatican webpage, and there wasn't a big banner blinking lights saying 50th anniversary of Vatican Council II. So am I missing something? Are they holding off on the big 5-0 celebration for 2015 when the council concluded after 50 years?
Well, it's hard to say. You know, they have Pope Benedict declared this as a year of faith and wants people to reflect on the council and particularly the teachings of the Catechism of the Catholic Church, many of which were products of the council or in some ways fine-tuned by the council. St. James Cathedral in Seattle had a series of about 5 or 6 lectures, including some of the major experts in the world on Vatican II. And those, drew lots of people. And I think you'll start to notice there's going to be I was just came back from University of Virginia 2 weeks ago. I was at a scholarly conference where we spoke about how Vatican II and its impact on Eastern Europe.
Mm.
I talked about the Czechs in particular. And so there's – I think there's stuff out there.
Yeah, I guess I should give a little bit of leeway here because the actual Vatican Council II opened, I think, in mid-October of 1962. So that's – that's only a couple months ago. So I guess you need to get the campaign for the 50th anniversary somewhat ramped up and probably for the different documents that came out and then when it all concludes in 2015. I'm sure there's going to be a big fireworks show in Italy, right?
Hopefully.
Okay, yeah. Very good. So let's get into this and figure out what the Vatican Council II was, or the Second Vatican Council. And I want to back this up historically because the word council seems to be important here. And what do we mean by councils in Catholicism or in Christianity in general? How have councils been used in Christianity, and what have been some of the big ones?
Well, this goes back to the Bible, really. If when there was a debate among the early Christians as to what extent do Christians need to follow Jewish law and customs, the apostles had a council in Jerusalem, and they discussed this. And Peter and Paul engaged each other on the issue, and that sort of set a precedent, really, for how Christians manage the church. And so, as Christianity spread, each town would have its own bishop. And when there was an issue to be dealt with, there was some potential heresy in the region, or people just had certain questions that were causing divisions or doubts, the bishops of the region would get together. They'd go to the major city, and they would have a council.
Yeah, so it's just a gathering to deal with some issues.
Yeah. So you had them in North Africa, in the Middle East, in Italy, in France. These were bring the bishops together to have a discussion.
But some of these councils seem to be a bigger deal than other ones.
Well, when you start to get really big issues that are the whole essence of Christianity hinges on, like is Jesus Christ fully God or not, or is he fully man and fully God? Is God a Trinity? And these kinds of questions, they would have a council whose decisions would then be binding on all Christians.
Mm-hmm.
They would meet. The early ones were always in the East, in like Nicaea or Constantinople or Ephesus, places like that. And they'd meet. They'd deal with these big issues and a lot of little issues too. And then they would issue their declarations or documents or laws, and then those would get accepted by the rest of the church. If you didn't accept one of those councils, you then split off into schism and you became a Nestorian or a Monophysite or some other term would be used, Arian or whatever. But basically, Christianity as we know it, Catholic, Protestant, and Eastern Orthodox, was its foundation was laid on those first several ecumenical councils. So the big one, Nicaea in 325, deals with the question of Jesus Christ and is he God, fully God. And then that was kind of reconfirmed in 381, and then 451 at Chalcedon, they dealt with that he's fully man and fully God. That was settled and accepted by practically all Christians at that point. And then in the Middle Ages, as when the Eastern and Western churches split, then the councils continue in the West, but not in the East.
Hmm.
So there's no more Eastern Orthodox Church council ever again that encompasses the entire church.
Is in part that because some of the Eastern Orthodox churches really became geographically limited in their scope? You had the Greek Orthodox, then the Russian Orthodox, et cetera, or is it and Western Catholicism was much more encompassing in that regard?
Well, I think it's more the fact that on the one hand, the Orthodox kind of we have it all figured out now.
Ah, okay.
We just got to hang on to what those first 7 councils have decided, and that's the Orthodox faith. And the other issue is that now that the church is divided, it's hard to think in terms of having an ecumenical council for all of Christianity. So, I mean, there should Eastern and Western churches ever reunite someday, there may be a big council.
No, there probably will, yeah.
But what happens in the Middle Ages is then the popes become the leaders of the council. Popes didn't go to the early councils. They just kind of approved from afar the decisions. And now the pope's pretty much in charge in the Middle Ages. And so you'll have councils, you know, a lot of the Lateran councils, which were held in Rome. That was the papal headquarters back then before it became the Vatican. And then also you're going to get in the 15th century something called the conciliar movement, where a number of Christians decided that the council should be more important than the pope and actually be like the board of directors that is over the pope. And so that was a fight for about three councils that were produced by that movement, and eventually the pope regained control. And then the last three councils there haven't been that many. There was Vatican II in the 60s. There was one in 1869, 1870, the Vatican I. And then the Council of Trent was in the 1545 to 1563. It was the aftermath of the Reformation.
So how many of the major councils have there been? I'm sure you could count little tiny regional things, but of...
Well, there's been 21.
21.
Of the ecumenical, or what they call general councils.
General councils, okay. So you're saying the last ones kind of peter out in the late 1500s, right?
I don't know if they peter out. There's going to be a big gap between, say, 1563 and 1869.
Yeah, that's 300 years or so.
And that's kind of a sense where I think that, you know, kind of like I was saying about the Orthodox. Like, you know, we've got it all figured out now at Trent, and we're just going to hang on to what we've decided. Mm-hmm. But then, you know, then the world changes. You know, you get the French Revolution, you get the Industrial Revolution, you get nationalism and pretty soon, socialism. Pretty soon it's like we're in a new world now, and we've got to sort of strengthen the church to confront this world. And that's what Vatican I did.
Yeah, I want to get back to Vatican I, but I'm still interested in this whole issue of councils. Actually, one of the things that's interesting is where these things take place. So, you know, you had the Council of Nicaea. That was in Nicaea, the eastern part of the Roman Empire, and that's where a lot of Christianity was happening at the time. That was the hopping place to be, and so
sure.
You can understand Constantine too wants to basically be consolidating his power in that territory as well. So you understand that, but you know some of these other ones, say the Council of Trent or the Lateran Councils, they're named after places. And is the place important, or is this like you know our American Political Science Association meets in New Orleans, then we go to Chicago, we just kind of share at the major cities, and I'm sure the American Historical Association does the same thing. Is there something important about place?
It all depends. So Lateran, you know, St. John Lateran is the Pope's church in Rome. To this day it is. You know, that's you can defeat people on trivia quizzes when you ask them what's the Pope's church, because they'll say St. Peter's, but it's actually St. John Lateran.
Ah.
That's the church where he's officially the pastor. He's the bishop.
And here's what research on religion it does. It prepares you for Trivial Pursuit.
There you go.
I mean, if anything,
sure.
that's I did not know that.
So you had about five, I think, at Lateran. And then you also have they're going to be – so it's the Council of Trent was held as close to Germany as possible because it was at the time of the Reformation, and there was thoughts of maybe even reunifying with the Lutherans. So they wanted to be close by for that.
Okay.
So now they're – you know, they tend to be it's hard to conceive of a council not being at the Vatican now. It's, you know, it's got the facilities, and it's pretty in modern times. The Pope has such a central role in Catholicism,
right?
And so that it seems a natural place to have these.
So yeah, so I guess if the next big council will be Vatican Council III, I guess
probably it would be amazing though if there was one in New York City or Paris or somewhere. But
Laramie, yeah. Wyoming, that would be cool. The Council of Laramie or something. I don't
Jackson
know.
Hole.
It's a beautiful area. Sure. Anyways, so let's get back to this issue of these important councils. And as you mentioned, there's this big gap between the 1560s and then what happens here at Vatican I. Since we're dealing with Vatican Council II, I don't want to deal with those earlier councils. But I do want to know about Vatican Council I, because the question comes up, if you have part two of something, well, what about part one? So, and it does seem to be somewhat bundled in the modern era. So what happens at Vatican Council I?
Okay, the most important thing I could say about Vatican I in terms of what we're talking about today is the big decision at Vatican I was the papal infallibility. And that was this view that the Pope, when speaking on faith and morals, ex cathedra, that means from the chair. I mean, in other words, when he's acting as leader of the church on specific issues involving faith and morals. And he, you know, he kind of makes it clear that this is going to be an infallible statement. Then he does. It's something very rarely used by popes.
Yeah.
But it was controversial at the time, but it passes with, you know, with a pretty solid vote. And they, in fact, the vote 433-2, but 660 of the bishops left so they wouldn't have to vote on it.
Oh, okay.
They were going to vote
against. They abstained.
Yeah. So, but what happens is that's part of it. A lot of this was a reaction to this is a time in the modern world, you know, Protestants were starting to become more fundamentalist and Christians were looking for something really solid because there this sense that the modern world was too relativistic and there were too many schools of thought out there that were contending and the church really needs to bring everybody together and rally around a single leader, single set of doctrines. And so this idea is you can count on the Pope.
Mm-hmm.
If we have some, you know, there was always believed that the church was infallible, but kind of vesting that in the Pope himself, elaborating that statement was what the council did. But the council was also supposed to deal then with the relationship between the Pope and the bishop. This is a huge issue. It's always been an issue. It's an issue right now as I speak. It's an issue in politics, you know, the center versus the periphery, you know, the federal government versus the states, the state capital versus the counties. We see this in all organizations. You see it everywhere, and it's in the church. And the question is, you know, is the Pope sort of the father of the church and the bishops are, you know, his sons, or is the Pope their brother? Are they all colleagues? Or is the Pope the CEO and are they the, you know, managing branches of the church? Or do they each have a church in their own right that is then in communion with the Pope? And these things have changed over time. You know, in the first 1,000 years, there was much more autonomy for bishops. And then the Pope started getting stronger. And particularly with Vatican I, the Pope's getting very strong in terms of control over the church. And so there was this need for a teaching of what is the bishop's role and how does the bishop relate to the Pope? And that never got dealt with because the council got cut short because the Franco-Prussian War broke out and the Italian army occupied Rome, which up till that point was owned by the Pope, and council had to disband. Everybody went home. So in a sense, since Vatican II was supposed to kind of pick up that question of collegiality, and it did to a certain extent. But even there, as it was dealt with, the language was, you know, very placed very carefully. There was a lot of conflict within the church between bishops that wanted autonomy and bishops that wanted a stronger subservience to the Pope. And so when the documents finally issued, there's not a clear implementation of the document. Mm-hmm. You know, exactly how are we going to bring this collegiality between Pope and bishops to fruition around the world? So these questions will come up like, you know, when there's going to be a change in the liturgical translation. You know, do the American bishops get to do it their way or will the Vatican step in and override them? And the Vatican seems to be a little stronger on these issues, in other words, more centralistic on some of these issues. And that's an ongoing fight. And it will always be an ongoing fight because you never can definitively solve these questions of center versus periphery.
Now, so you dated that around Franco-Prussian War. So this is the 1870s, right?
Yeah, so it's 70s when the council ends.
The council ends. Okay. So and this is a time when Europe is changing a lot. Mm-hmm. There's the Industrial Revolution is several decades in process now, and the communications mm-hmm. have changed. People can move around transportation-wise mm-hmm. easier. So we see a much different world emerging here. And that brings me up to Vatican Council II, because I want to know what inspires Vatican Council II. Mm-hmm. You mentioned Vatican Council I. We want to deal with this new environment that mm-hmm. everything's changing so rapidly, and we need to invest the Pope with infallibility to have some moral anchor here. Mm-hmm. I can only imagine that this is going to occur into the 20th century because change doesn't slow down. Mm-hmm. It speeds up.
Well, it's very interesting, why Vatican II. And first of all, first point, the church was not in crisis in 1962.
Okay.
In fact, there was a religious revival in Europe in the aftermath of World War II. People were going to church. It was a pretty much happy time in Europe by the early 60s.
Let me stop you there. That's very interesting to know because my vision of why Vatican Council II was called for was that, oh my gosh, Europe is so secular now, we need to revitalize the church. But this is interesting, a religious revival in Europe.
The secularization really starts to pick up in the 60s.
So you
don't really – there's not the sense that the church is in crisis.
Okay.
There's definitely awareness of changes in the world, which the church regarded as good change. So a stronger sense of workers' rights and organized labor was considered a good thing. The decolonization and liberation of the countries in Africa and Asia was considered a good thing. And so there was a sense – the world is changing in ways – there's a real sense of optimism in Vatican II. And the key person here, of course, is Pope John XXIII,
right,
who really kind of embodied that optimism. And he also – one of the big changes in context is the church became less anti-communist in the sense that, you know, under Pius XII, I mean, anti-communism was a cornerstone of Catholic teaching. Of course, the communists were hostile to the Catholic Church, so it made sense.
Mm-hmm.
Pius XII put his hat in with the United States in the Cold War, became a big ally of U.S. in the 50s. And then when John XXIII becomes pope, he's much more he wants to get along with communists and socialists in Italy. He wants to get along with Soviet Union. There's already this concern now that there might be a nuclear war.
Mm-hmm.
And so you have to, you know, build these better relations. And, of course, the Soviet Union's changed. Stalin's gone. Now it's Khrushchev. He's
right.
A little more open and engaging. So it's a new world in that regard as well. Now, Pius XII was considering having a Vatican II.
Okay, and, that's why yeah. I wanted to ask.
And these were secret plans. It wasn't public.
Okay.
But they were doing some of the prep work. And it was going to be more of a council that just reaffirms the Catholic teaching and kind of we're right, everybody else is wrong, this is why they're wrong, this is why we're right, we've got to fight against modern. In a sense, those modernization that goes back to the French Revolution or even earlier, mm-hmm. the Enlightenment and all that. I mean, they want to have a council that really going to reaffirm Catholic truth in the face of those things. But when John XXIII becomes pope, he wants a council for very different reasons. He wants a council that will bring the church up to date. He used the term aggiornamento, like bringing, like you know, giorno in Italian, like, you know, buongiorno, good day, you know, bringing it up to today, aggiornamento. The metaphor he used, open the window and the new fresh air will blow in.
Well, let me ask you about this because I'm that was one of the big questions I had was mm-hmm. that whether this was in the making for a couple years,
mm-hmm.
and you indicate Pope Pius XII has secret plans or mm-hmm. at least not publicized
right,
plans. We don't
want
to
yeah.
make it sound malicious or anything. But he said, okay, let's get a council here. I assume those plans don't make it to fruition because he dies.
Yeah, he dies.
He dies. And John the 23rd is the one who comes after.
Right.
Okay. So in terms of those two popes, I mean, you give mm-hmm. an indication that John the 23rd is much more open to détente with the mm-hmm. communists. It's not quite the term being thrown around yet, mm-hmm. but they seem to be maybe a leading pathway mm-hmm. to this. Are there any other differences between Pius the 12th and John the 23rd?
Well, definitely. You know, Pius is – by the 50s, he's getting very old. He never really leaves his room in the Vatican. Having some sort of mystical experiences, or at least that's what the Vatican is letting us know about him. He's, you know, kind of just defensive in a lot of ways. His world is his closest circle of advisors.
Mm-hmm.
And so he's already, you know, and he's kind of set in his ways. You know, he's fought the Cold War and he's not as conservative a figure as we think. You know, some of the teachings of Vatican II are going to start with Pius XII, having a more modern approach to scripture
mm-hmm.
is something that Pius reforming the liturgy is something that's actually going to start with Pius XII. So he's pushing the church, but in other ways he was disturbed by some of the new theology, and he kind of cracked down on some of that in the 50s. The great American theologian John Courtney Murray, who really helps bring about the Catholic teaching on freedom of conscience and religious liberty, he was silenced under Pius XII by his superiors in the early 50s for saying things that the Vatican didn't like. So Pius was, but whereas John the 23rd was much more he was a traditional. He wasn't as liberal as we think. He was a traditional
yeah.
Catholic as well. But he had this very engaging personality, very open to the world. He'd just go, you know, hugging people and walking down the street if he could, you know, visiting hospitals and popping up in prisons and whatnot. And was very very just always thought of the positive, kind-hearted greetings
yeah.
to people and was a very kind of a fat, happy Italian of peasant origin that was really put in as a caretaker. He was already old. They couldn't decide on who to replace Pius XII with, so they thought, well, let's just put John there. He's going to die soon anyway. He'll be a pope for just a couple of years, and then we'll have another election. And John shocked everybody by calling a council.
Wow.
And we're gonna up.
Now, was he in on any discussions with Pius XII? Saying, did he know that Pius was going to call that?
No, he wasn't that high up. He was an ambassador during the. He did a lot during the Holocaust to help Jews. He was an important Vatican ambassador, but once the war was over, he was kind of just, given a sinecure to just live out his life, and then, bam, he's back in at the top.
Okay.
And one thing, important point, he was very ecumenical. He believed in the brotherhood of all Christians, and he announces Vatican II on January 25th, 1959, which was – January 25th is the Feast of the Conversion of St. Paul, and that's the day that Christians chose – to culminate the week of – there's a week of Christian unity. We don't hear much about it today, but it's there on the calendar, and Protestants have it too. And it's a week when churches are supposed to focus on Christian unity, and it ends on January 25th. So John the 23rd chose that as the day to make the announcement. And he also announced that they will have Protestants and non-Catholic Christians will be allowed to be observers at Vatican II. And nothing like that had ever happened at a church council. So this sense of, reaching out, building bridges, healing past divisions, all these things are part of the whole personality and mood of John the 23rd. And so that's going to become sort of the spirit of the council.
This is interesting. I didn't know when it was called. And so there's January 25th of 1959. It is officially opened in October, I think October 11th of 1962.
Yeah.
So that's, that's 3.5 years there. What?
Oh, good question. So here, what they do is they send out invitations, or not invitations, but the first thing they did was they sent out letters soliciting input.
Okay.
They sent out, I have my data here, they sent about 2,500 letters, and they got and 2,000 responses, so it was about a 77% response rate.
Oh, that's pretty good in service.
And that's really good. We were talking about these things the other day.
Who did these letters get sent to?
They went to bishops, archbishops, cardinals, anybody in
bishops
the hierarchy.
Bishops and above,
abbots, guys who run monasteries.
Okay.
And then the leaders of religious orders, and I think also maybe like the chairman of theological departments at Catholic universities.
Hmm.
So they got all this data, and they went through it, and they ranged anywhere from a 6-line reply to a 27-page reply. I mean, some guys had a whole big agenda they wanted to discuss, and some guys just had one point to discuss. And so you end up with all this stuff, and some of it was fairly traditional and conservative, like we need to reaffirm our teachings about Mary, and others was more kind of like progressive and looking for change. And they all this stuff comes to the Vatican. They sort through it all. They set up about 10 commissions. They end up with 16 ultimately. And then they dealt with different parts of church teaching. So a commission for, the media, commission for relations with Protestants, commission for the church in the world, commissions for how do you deal with bishops, things like that. And then these commissions will write up draft documents. So they write up the documents, and then 2,850 people were invited to Vatican II. And over the course of the event, over those 4 years, about 2,860 people took part. These are the so-called council fathers. These are the bishops and cardinals and the guys that got to vote. But they also had to compare that, when the Council of Trent opened, there were 29 people.
Yeah, that's a small one.
And then it got a little bigger over the years. And Vatican I had 750. So this is, four times the size of Vatican I already. And they also brought about 500 so-called periti. A peritus was it's a Latin word for the expert. So these were either bishops and cardinals brought their personal secretaries who would do the – or some theologian from their country that they could trust, or the pope would just appoint some. So some of these were – Joseph Ratzinger, who's now the pope, was one of these periti. Karl Rahner. I mean, it was some of the major theologians in the world were there. Plus you had about 1,000 journalists. And then you had all these visitors, Eastern Orthodox visitors and Protestant visitors. And so about 7,500 people took part in the whole council. So it was a big show, and now, it got heavily covered.
Now, we know it lasts 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
Was it anticipated to last that long?
No.
Or they were going to say, hey, you know, come on out. We'll talk for a week. Everything will be great. You know, this is how Nicaea went. Yeah. And but, you know, all of a sudden, wow, we need more folding chairs.
That was, well, the plan was, yeah, the plan was it'll be pretty quick because they figured, you know, the Vatican is run by, the institution is called the Curia. And this is like the, like, you know, the President Obama has his administration and the Pope's administration is the Curia. These are the departments, secretariats at the Vatican. And those are the guys that draw up the draft. And they're used to pretty much running the church and certainly not having bishops tell them what to do. Well, when they meet at Vatican II, they're presenting their drafts. And the first thing they present is the list of people who you're supposed to vote for these various commissions that will be set up now at Vatican II to go through the drafts.
Okay.
And some bishops said, well, why do we just have to vote for the list you're giving us? Can't we? We don't know half these people. Maybe we should network and try to decide, like, who we want. And it's sort of – people start saying, yeah, 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 here, here. And pretty soon they're going to have a real, like, discussions. And they have a recess. They have discussions. And then they start to vote in different people on commissions than the Curia initially wanted in some cases. And then they start to challenge some of the curial documents. Say, well, I don't like this document here. I don't think this is right or this is right or this is right. And we want to change this. And pretty soon you start to get debate. And the Curia and then John the 23rd, who didn't really have any strong position when this all started, he starts to side with the reformers, saying, well, yeah, let's talk about these things. Let's have some debate. Let's have some changes. And so he kind of gives them cover. And pretty soon you start to have debates breaking out, and it really builds a momentum. And pretty soon you get the majority, you know, about 70-80% of the council are pushing for changes. Mm-hmm. You know, it depending upon the issue, the numbers would change or the personnel would change. But overall, you're getting like probably, you know, three-fourths of the council is pushing for change, and the other fourth is trying to make sure there's not too much change, too fast change, or the wrong kind of change. And that pretty much holds for those 3 years. So they end up having to have four sessions. They have 62, 63, 64, 65. And they're like a fall quarter. They come in October, they go home in early December.
Okay. That was one of the things I was going to ask.
For 4 years.
Yeah, because you come in, you got to reserve a hotel room or you got to have some space at the Vatican residences. And, you're here for, you know, 3 years. When do I get to go home?
When you got all that work back home to do. Yeah. These are just these autumnal sessions.
Okay.
And once they're over, then you have all the networking and revising and whatnot going on behind the politicking, going on behind the scenes. And then, of course, the media is covering it. I think the New Yorker had regular reports and major journalists were over there writing about all of these things. So the world was really watching. I mean, it was front page news and New York Times. That
must have been pretty interesting, too, because we oftentimes think of the church and some of these councils as being fairly cloistered. Now, part of it was just, hey, it's in the medieval ages and there isn't a big press around.
Right.
But so this must have added a different dynamic to the whole thing with cameras and newspaper reporters and radio.
And they're not supposed to be talking about what's going on in the closed sessions, but stuff leaks out like crazy.
Yeah, yeah.
Because you've got priests kind of working as journalists who have connections with the cardinals.
Yeah.
And certain groups want to leak certain things out and so there's all sorts of maneuvering going on. And the Pope will sometimes, he'll take a trip or give a speech. Like for them, when they're debating ecumenism, the council ends and the first thing he does, he goes to Jerusalem and meets the Eastern Orthodox Patriarch. So it's a kind of, or he goes to when they're debating human rights and freedom of conscience, he goes to the UN and gives us a speech on religious freedom.
Oh, and I can only imagine people reading so much into that.
Yeah. So lots was going on. It was very I was too young to really remember it. It'd be really exciting if there was a Vatican III just for the sake of you hold your breath during these councils because you don't know what they're going to come up with.
Mm-hmm.
But it'd be really exciting to watch.
So it's interesting. They meet every autumn for four sessions. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of politicking going on. They had solicited all these letters that obviously snowballs into everybody's issues, starts becoming important. What were some of the major issues that emerged at Vatican Council II?
Okay. They dealt with practically everything. This was the most comprehensive council ever. Nothing came – Trent probably came the closest because it had to sort of – bolster Catholic teaching in the face of the Reformation, which was a wide challenge to the church. But this deals with everything, religious, non-religious. It dealt with, from the most trivial issues to the biggest ones, what do nuns wear? How should you bless the baptismal water? What role should Thomas Aquinas have in Catholic education? How should Catholics approach Scripture? Should there be changes in the mass? What should Catholic teaching be on war, on the economy, on and on and on? So they discussed just about everything. So I'll start out by telling you what they didn't discuss. The issues of the church, there were about three or four things the Pope pulled out of the council, or in other ways they weren't to be discussed. Birth control was taken out of the council.
Okay.
Should priests be celibate? That was taken out of the council. Reform of the curia, council wasn't allowed to talk about that. And then they never really definitively figured out how do you implement collegiality. They affirmed it as a principle that bishops are colleagues with the Pope, but never really settled it. It's still kind of an issue up in the air.
And that's the issue we were talking about before, right? About center and periphery.
Yep.
And okay.
But everything else. So this is the council that there were certain documents. In fact, the documents that were the most tightly contested tend to be the ones that were saying the most important things. So the big one was called Gaudium et Spes, you know, joy and hope. It's on the church in the modern world. And this deals with, you know, human dignity. It talks about marriage. It talks about the church's relation to culture. It talks about the socioeconomic teachings, war. You know, the Cuban Missile Crisis happened right when Vatican II was opening. And so nuclear war was on everybody's mind the whole way through. And you had bishops trying to get the council to outlaw war. You had bishops trying to get a statement against nuclear weapons. The U.S. pushed against those initiatives to sort of save nuclear weapons.
Actually, let me ask that. Did the U.S. have an ambassador that was trying to influence things? Did other nations have that?
Oh, you mean the actual governments?
Yeah.
I don't know enough about that. It's hard to – I mean, we tend to – you'd think we shouldn't be trying – Spelman, who was the head of the American church, the major American – was in touch with the government. So he would be there, if in a sense, the ambassador, I would say.
Okay, yeah, channeled through him.
Yeah.
Okay.
So he did very much represented American interests on these kinds of issues and pushed back against the continental Europeans. So that's going to be – another big one is going to be the Lumen Gentium, which was about the church itself. And that's where they, you know, talk about the universal call to holiness, where, you know, it's not just monks and nuns, but all Christians are called to be holy. And they talk about a little bit more about the, you know, the structure of the church and how we think that it's a pilgrim church. Now that they're admitting now that the church moves through history, that it's not just kind of floating around in the clouds eternally, unchanging, but it actually engages history.
Is this the document that, you know, many people talk about Vatican Council II as democratizing the church? Is this the centerpiece for that?
Well, it doesn't democratize the church.
So okay.
Woven through most of the documents, though, is the sense of like giving more role to the lay people.
Mm-hmm.
More participation in church. You're going to start to get parish councils set up where people can give their input to the priest.
And that's why I'd consider democratization. Maybe I should use the term liberalization. In terms of that,
or increasing like lay apostolate or something. There's different ways they would put it, where people aren't just kind of passively in the church, or even the idea. I think what you're getting at is there was this traditional view that the church is the bishops and the priests,
right?
That's the church and the Pope,
yeah.
And Vatican II starts talking about church as people of God.
Okay,
it's everybody's in the church. It's like Martin Luther's priesthood of all believers is now finally kind of sinking in the Catholic Church, and that, you know, we're all called to holiness. We're all part of the church. The church is us. It is mm-hmm. we the church. You even hear this word sometimes. And Pope John Paul used that a lot. That people of God, people of God, people of God is the church. Dignitatis Humanae is their declaration on religious freedom. That was the big one. That was the one the Americans had the most input on. People from multi-religious countries that had democratic traditions pushed for this very hard. People from the kind of the mono-religious societies like Spain and Portugal and some of the Latin American countries didn't like this.
Yeah.
But it got through, and that's going to transform the way Catholics think about other religions, other people. And then finally, the big one, a very big one, was a very short one called Nostra Aetate, which means in our age. And it's about Catholic relations with other religions, Jews, Muslims, Hindus, Buddhists, and others. And this was very positive. And it just goes one by one through these religions and talks about how, you know, how all the good things about Hindus and Buddhists and Muslims and Jews. It condemns anti-Semitism. It really opens the door for this huge kind of outreach now that the Catholic Church has had ever since toward, you know, Muslims and Jews and other religions. So those are going to really, you know, the way, for example, John Paul II has embraced Muslims, it would hard to imagine like Pius XII taking a similar kind of a position. I mean, it's a new church in terms of what's called interreligious dialogue, and then also ecumenism. You know, sort of getting. I mean, Catholics couldn't go to funerals or weddings at Protestant churches back in the day, and now it's like they're encouraged to even have Bible studies with Protestants, and you go to their services. I mean, you got to do it with the right attitude. You can't be like indifferent to the differences, but the idea that you can now fellowship with other Christians is that's a big change. People that are old enough to remember the really old people, just amazed, like, oh, some Catholic girl married a Protestant boy. Oh, it's just so amazing.
I want to get to that because, yeah. I mean, there's a story in my own family between my Uncle Gordy and Aunt Marilyn who were married. Uncle Gordy was Catholic and Aunt Marilyn was a Lutheran. And it created a big issue, right? And this, I'm pretty sure they would have been married before 1965, before any of this came out. And I remember later on they reaffirmed their vows. I remember attending the wedding, and I was a younger kid then too. I'm like, well, aren't they already married? What's this all about? So did that the note? In the Latin term here, in our age, Nostra Aetate, did that deal with marriage issues? Did it allow for ecumenical marriages?
That Nostra Aetate was about other religions.
Okay.
But there was a decree on ecumenism that and there's a decree – I don't know that Vatican II specifically addressed that issue, but it created laid down the principles.
Yeah, opens
where
the door.
That would be.
Yeah.
And then it all has to get implemented and discussed. But no, it really, uncle and aunt had the exact same issue.
Yeah.
And they saw kind of John the 23rd as kind of their vindicator.
Yeah. There. Yeah.
And he's, and they're meeting with, they're inviting, Episcopate or Anglican bishops to come to the Vatican, and they're giving him gifts and hugging them and calling them brother and reaching out to the Eastern Orthodox and all of those things. So it was a real breakthrough that we sometimes forget because it seems so normal now that these Christians would get along.
Well, that's interesting because you mentioned these four major documents that come out, and the ones that you hear most about is Gaudium et Spes and Dignitas Humanae. How do you pronounce that?
Dignitas Humanae.
Humanae, right. But you don't hear about the other two. Is there a reason for that? Is it just because, nowadays ecumenism is the in thing, so we never talk about that much, or what?
It was short. It's I'm not sure why you're not hearing about these. I mean, it's not that. First of all, we don't always call them by their. It doesn't have the snappy name in our age, where on human dignity or religious freedom or church in the modern world has. But no, they've. I'm talking in terms of the impact. I mean, they've really impacted.
Right.
In ways that just make it very different from what came before.
Let's talk about that. Okay. Now. Let's talk about the impact that this has. Of these four major documents, which one do you think had the biggest impact?
Well, it's hard to – the thing about was really unique about – there are a number of things unique about Vatican II. And one of the things – no council had so many people coming.
Right.
No council produced so much material. They had about 300 pages of decisions, which if you line up all of the other 20 councils – and then you put Vatican II next to it. It takes up about a third of the other 20.
Wow. Okay.
So it's pretty sizable. It was the first one that let non-Catholics come and attend. It didn't condemn anything. Almost every other council had a list of condemnations. Some, that's practically all the council did. And Vatican II didn't condemn. Only thing that got condemned at Vatican II was anti-Semitism and nuclear arms stockpiling. Nothing else. And so that was unusual. The whole style of dialogue and invitation and persuasion and inclusion and partnership and engagement, just the whole language was unlike anything else. But then the point you just made was that – or what I want to make in response to what you said was it's not that there's so much a specific document, but there's this spirit that runs through all the documents. Okay. That we're gonna, we're gonna engage people. We're gonna persuade rather than pontificate. We're going to reach out, build bridges. We're gonna look at the world. We're gonna see the good in the world and not just the bad. We're gonna learn from the world and not just teach the world. I mean, that's across the board in everything. And so whatever issue you look at within the church, there's going to be some, you know, how should nuns dress? Well, they're going to start to dress more like everyday people mm-hmm. so they can be out in the world. You know, how should you do the Mass? Well, we're going to start doing it in the native languages now so people can understand it. We're mm-hmm. going to have the people participating in the prayers. And the priest is going to face you rather than face the other way. How are we going to deal with communism? We're not going to condemn it at the council. We're going to try to build bridges. You know, and they condemned communism vigorously at the council. The communist delegates would not have been, the delegates from communist countries wouldn't allow, have allowed, been allowed to come to mm-hmm. the council. So Karl Wojtyla wouldn't have come, and there would be no Pope John Paul II because he got a lot of his connections for becoming pope from being at the council. He was very impressive performer at the council. So lots of things. So it's that whole kind of spirit, and that's where one of the, in terms of like impact of Vatican II. You're going to get like the ecumenism is going to be, you know, the interreligious dialogue. You know, there was the case where the Pope kissed a Quran when he was meeting visitors from Iran, or I'm sorry, from Iraq mm-hmm. during the Iraq War. He wasn't affirming this is the word of God. He was just accepting a gift.
Okay.
Oh. But that was hard to imagine that from an earlier.
Yeah, I mean, in terms of the impact, and again, I grew up Catholic, mm-hmm. and one of the impacts that I know, and I was not old enough to really understand what was going on during Vatican Council II. But one of the impacts that I noted, and this is through my older relatives and, uh-huh. and my grandmother, is I remember going to a church, and upstairs you had the old traditional Mass with the incense and everything like that. But downstairs, and my folks started taking this, you know, we had
the folk mass.
Yeah, the teenagers in sandals singing Michael, Row Your Boat Ashore on the guitar, right? You know, and so what other changes did this bring into the church?
Well, this is a good point, because with Vatican II, one of the points was that aggiornamento. You want to bring the church up to date. Mm-hmm. You want to adapt the church to the world around it. And that's a big problem. You know, it raises that question of change versus continuity.
Mm-hmm.
And that's another one of those unsolvable questions. And if you're conservative, you're suspicious of change. You don't want change to be too much. You don't want to be chasing after fads, because that'll damage the church's credibility. At the same time, if something never changes, it dies. Like John Henry Newman says, you know, it's to change is to be alive. And you know, if you don't change, you end up like some little sect, you know, like living out in some rural Amish or the old believers or something, that you know, you're preserving your ways, but you're not engaged with the culture around you. So the key is, how do you change to engage the culture without like kind of losing touch with your essence? So things like is the church adapting itself to the modern world, or is a church adapting itself to the early 60s or mid 60s?
Uh-huh.
And so a friend of mine once said, you know, if Vatican II had happened in the 40s, they would have been playing big band music at your church. But it's the 60s, so it's folk music.
Yeah.
And so that idea is, you know, and so some people say, you know, that there's this spirit of Vatican II, which isn't so much just what was produced there, but actually this idea that you engage the world, you keep changing, you keep – so this will come up with, say, issues like women's ordination. So they didn't talk about women's issues much, almost at all, at Vatican II. It was a little too early for those to become issues that were really on the table of the world. Had Vatican II happened 10 years later, they would have had to talk about that a lot. So it doesn't get talked about. So if you're someone that – once more, you know, this sort of progressive liberal Catholic, then you'll say, well, the spirit of Vatican II is you engage the world, you try to adapt the church to the world, and so we should, you know, have women pastors and whatnot. And then if you're conservative, you say, no, this is, you know, this is really just, you go by the letter of what they did at Vatican II. And you just say, kind of book closed on anymore. We've reformed enough. That's enough progress, and we're going to stick with that. And so you get these ongoing divisions in the church, and there's definitely a new study. Catholics are much more encouraged to read the Bible than before Vatican II. And like I said, the ecumenical relations and whatnot. But one of the big, and I think you'll appreciate this. One of the big issues that comes up in theology is there are these two concepts. One is called development, and one is called ressourcement. It's a French word. Go back to the sources. And a lot of times, reform movements involve ressourcement. So you know, you decide like to revitalize ourselves today. We go back to the. You go back to the Gospels. You go back to the Fathers of the Church. Or in the Renaissance, we go back to the ancient Greeks and Romans to sort of, you know, to reform our Americans today, they say, you got to go back to the Founding Fathers to capture the essence of who we are as a people, and that in the interim, we got off track a bit. And so that's one view. You know, the church kind of got off track through the Middle Ages. We got to get back to our sources and our inspirations. And so a lot of those theologians of the early, you know, 3rd, 4th, 5th, 6th centuries were very popular for reform-minded Catholics in the 20th century.
Very interesting.
The other view is development, which is that as the church develops over the centuries, as it moves through history, it's organically growing. So everything that's happening is the right sort of thing. And so this will come up with the issue like how strong should the Pope be? So if you believe in development, you say, well, over history, the Pope got stronger and stronger, and that's the way it's meant to be. It's sort of the unfolding of the original teaching through history.
Mm-hmm.
If you're in Ressourcement, you'll say, actually, let's go. If you go back to the early church, the Pope wasn't that strong. He was more of a colleague to the bishops, and we got to capture that spirit. That'll help bring about Christian unity today, and we can revitalize the church by having a more collegial Pope. And the two are kind of at cross purposes. An American example would be, you know, people say that, you know, well, you know, if you go back to the principles of the founding fathers, you know, yeah, they were for slavery and they didn't respect women's rights, but they had certain teachings or beliefs that as you move through history, those beliefs kind of unfold and more people get included in this original promise. In other words, it's developing organically the way it's supposed to. So you take these kind of perspectives, and the key is to kind of hold that together. So like, we're going to revitalize the church, but without breaking from our tradition and in a way that's going to bring things up to date. So that's one of the big issues that came up at Vatican II as well. And I'll say the one thing that I wrestled with for a while was you get these bishops, they're in their 40s, 50s, and 60s, these council fathers, most of them. And so if you think about a third of them or so are Europeans. So you're thinking these guys, when they were in their teens, 20s, and 30s, they're living through the Great Depression. When they're in their 20s, 30s, and 40s, they're living through World War II and the Holocaust. So they've experienced the worst during their careers. And yet they come to Vatican II and they produce this very upbeat, people say even naively optimistic set of commentary and teachings about the church and the world. And I always thought, like, what would explain that? Like, why? You'd think these guys would be bitter, paranoid, defensive, despairing, hopeless. But the difference, as I was talking to a scholar of this field, and she said, you know, think about what those guys saw for the last 15 years. They saw Europe go from utterly devastated, hopeless, looked like it would never recover, to this happy, prosperous, successful. And there was that, and I remember there was that optimism of the early 60s. When I was a little kid in school, we'd get these junior scholastic magazines, and they would always have stories about kids around the world our age. And it was always just how Africa's developing. They've got freedom, and they're developing, and Asia's developing, and we're getting space age technology. And there was this real sense that the world is just getting better and better and better. And that was the, I think, these guys had seen that. It went from World War II and Holocaust to like this world that's getting better. And it really looked like there was just a lot of hope for the future. And so that really comes through in Second Vatican Council. And then, of course, bad things are going to start to happen. And we're living in a world now where people are, you know, like much more anxious about the future.
Yeah.
But so I think that was one of the remarkable features of it coming at the time that it did.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask about this. So this, you know, we see changes. We see nuns wearing blue jeans. We see the folk mass. We see this hope. We see the ecumenical movement of broadening, reaching out, greater acceptance, religious liberty. A lot of great things that come from this. But with a billion Catholics, one could only imagine that some folks are not going to be none too pleased with this. Has there been any pushback to some of these changes? And actually, I'm going to frame this in terms of something that we discussed before on one of our earlier podcasts on Pope John Paul II. John Paul II is in many ways, and I think you've mentioned unfairly, a person who is characterized as somebody who pulled the church back in or reined the church back in from the reforms of Vatican Council II. Has there been any backlash or movement away from the reform during John Paul II, or, you know, Cardinal Ratzinger is known as a theological conservative? What's your thoughts there?
Well, you know, for real, John Paul considers himself total defender and supporter of Vatican II. I mean, he sees himself as just bringing the council to fruition. His favorite pope, as far as if we judge by who he talks about and quotes the most, was Paul VI, the pope that brought Vatican II to conclusion. So now, what happened, I think, it all gets caught up into church politics and just politics in general. If you're liberal Catholic, then you had all these hopes that Vatican II was just the beginning of what was going to be even more and more liberalization. And
this women's whole spirit, ordination, that kind of stuff.
Yeah. And so and contraception being allowed and so on. So when this stuff doesn't happen, then that's kind of – it wasn't in Vatican II. These are things that you're hoping will continue. And when that doesn't continue, then there's a sense that, you know, that somehow the Pope is restoring the old church. Because he's not. He's not restoring the old church. He's just not letting the church change. Okay? If you're conservative, then there's a sense that, yeah, bad changes have happened, and the church has got. The best is if you look at the secularization. So yeah. The decline of numbers of practicing Catholics. In a lot of places. If you're liberal, you'll say, well, that's because the church hasn't kept reforming, and it's making itself irrelevant and old-fashioned. If you're conservative, you'll say that's because the church reformed too much in the '60s and lost confidence and wasn't forcefully countering all of these. And if you're just someone like you or I that thinks in terms of sociology and politics, a lot of it could just be explained by there was a rebellion against authority across the board. Everybody, whether it was the military, the government, business, churches, and that was bigger than Vatican II or anything else. I mean, that was this huge social cultural movement, and it probably there wasn't much the church was going to do one way or the other to
stem
it.
It was just caught in that wave, yeah.
But you can, it all depends how you interpret it. Nobody can really prove these things one way or the other. But I think so. John Paul is kind of more like a more guarded or cautious change or implementation of Vatican II, but not because there's always that fear that you change too fast and things get out of control, or some country's church goes off in a direction where it's almost in schism, and Pope's job is to kind of hold this all together.
Yeah, you worry about the faz because church has 2,000 years of history
people. Yeah. There was that kind of throw out the baby with the bathwater that some people did after Vatican II. Like, let's just get rid of everything old. Let's stop, May crownings and rosary marches and this and that. And what he ended up having was now there's a backlash against that, and people want more tradition.
Yeah, yeah.
And what's interesting, I this is my own analogy. I like it. Baseball stadiums. If you look at the old baseball stadiums like Wrigley Field and Forbes Field, and some of them were they were really rickety and uncomfortable and old-fashioned. And so in the 70s, everybody wanted to build these nice, modern, like Shea Stadium and Riverfront Stadium and Three River Stadium. These, and they all looked the same. They were modern. And I remember they looked so great and exciting. And then up throughout 10 years, you get really tired of these. Like, they all look the same. They don't have any charm. They're too comfortable in a certain sense, like but in the wrong sort of ways. And then you kind of have this yearning for those old stadiums, but you want them to come back in a more comfortable way. So without the beams in front of you when you're trying to sit out there in the left field, or with nice refreshment stands and softer chairs and all this. And I think that's what basically happens. People, you had that traditional church of Pius XII. It became the Vatican II church. And then people started to say, well, there was a certain charm to that old church, but we don't want to go back to it. But we want to kind of like recreate it in a more modern way, and I think that's what John Paul and Benedict XVI, that's their Catholic Church. It's trying to reconnect with some of those older ways of doing things, like maybe more Latin Mass, more traditional types of prayers, but still in a modern way. Mm-hmm. They're not like kicking out the lay people or putting up barriers against other, Christians and other religions. I mean, they're really trying to kind of work with Vatican II, but in a more guarded way. Certainly more guarded way than the more liberal Catholics would want them to.
Let me go ahead and conclude with this question. And what your perspective on this is fascinating, and I really enjoy it. There's a dialectical process that has happened over the past 50 years or so with the church. Now things continue to change. The world is getting different. The Cold War is over. There's new challenges that we face. Increasingly, we see more of the population of the world in the developing world, where Catholicism has made great strides. Not only, bulwark in Latin America, you could say all the time, but it's increasing in Africa. It's increasing in Asia and China, in of all places. In terms of Vatican Council II and Catholicism in the next 50 years? Where do you see things going? Do you see another Vatican III being called for these new issues? Do you think Vatican Council II is what will carry us through the next 50 years of Catholicism? And what is the state of Catholicism today and in the future?
Oh, but, you know, as a historian, you know, we always hate to predict the future.
I know. But on this show, we make you do that. So.
It's hard to, you know, that definitely the center of gravity of Catholicism shifting to the developing world. Or even in the United States, a lot of Catholicism is, once again, immigrant Catholicism. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of, you know, kind of infusing a life into the church. I think we'll see a non-European pope. I think I thought we were going to get one already this time. And I think that Ratzinger's election was kind of the last attempt to kind of revitalize Catholicism in Europe by having a real European in there that's going to deal with these issues that are facing Europe. But I think, you know, it's sooner or later there'll be a pope from, you know, Brazil or you know, some Philippines or some part of the what used to be, you know, now getting pretty developed, but the so-called – used to be called the Third World. So I think that'll happen. In terms of, you know, how – societies are going to evolve. It's really hard to predict. You know, you could see on one of the church getting smaller and kind of more tightly organized. Some people think that's what Ratzinger wants anyways, like just get the – because, you know, the church always has that, like, on the one, it wants to be the church of everybody. That's why it's called Catholic. It's like the arms of St. Peter hugging the world. And the church has long been very tolerant of, like, you know, believers. It doesn't try to drive people out of the church. It'll you know, you can kind of be in the church almost kind of on your own terms.
It is truly the big tent religion. Yeah.
It'll be a big tent. And if you want to tighten that up and make it kind of like the, you know, the special forces or the Marines or whatever, it's going to get smaller. It might get tougher. It might get, you know, it might be more cohesive. Hard to say. But it'll be smaller. And certainly it won't be the church anymore. That it'll be a different kind of a church. It'll almost become just another denomination instead of the church. So I'm always kind of reluctant when, you know, particularly more conservative Catholics are real eager about, let's just tighten up the church and have it just be for the best people. Because that's the old Donatist heresy of early Christianity, is the church is for the best people and all the kind of the lax people and the slackers and the whatnot need to be kind of driven out. And so, you know, when the church takes a really hard stand on some issue that's going to alienate believers, it's heading in that direction. When the church tries to, like, kind of downplay some of the conflict with society, then that's kind of trying to keep it more. And there's, you know, you can see the pluses and minuses in both ways. It's always going to be an issue. Is, you know, where do you draw the line in the sand and say we're not going to cross, or where do you accommodate the world? And so it's hard to say how the church is. You know, is it going to get kind of leaner and meaner, or is it going to get? You can always. It's just hard to tell. Or even, you know, if you believe that this is all the working of the Holy Spirit, then, you know, what's God's plan for the church? Is he going to save this remnant, or is really there going to be this springtime evangelization and more people become Christian? I mean, it could spread in China, for example, mm-hmm. in a big way, which would really change the whole picture of world religion. Or you could see just, you know, you see a secularization in the United States or somewhere that so far has been religious. So it's very hard to – but now so much of it too is on individual basis. Like, it's not just like our ethnic group is this religion and therefore we're this religion. But there's so much intermixing and moving around the world now that you can't – when I was growing up, you met an Italian. They were Catholic. I mean, they just – even if they didn't go to church, they said they were Catholic. Now they could be all sorts of different religions. Right. And it's a little and all the, you know, the denomination hopping that goes on in the United States and non-denominational churches and so just the whole categorization is going to have to change. But, you know, Catholics still have that sense of a Catholic identity. I mean, they definitely know they're Catholics and they're not something else. And things that I think foster that identity, as long as it's not like too off-putting to non-Catholics, are probably going to be strength of the church. You know, that you really – there really are certain things that you do or think because you're Catholic. And so I think that's – kind of at least keeping that much going will help the church in the long run.
I think it will, and we'll have to keep an eye out because change is always occurring, and we'll be sure to visit back with you again when you get your book on the visits of John Paul II, and you're going to be our Catholic go-to guy because just dynamic. So, James, I want to thank you once again for being on Research on Religion.
Well, my pleasure, Tony. I just love coming on here.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.